Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds. I'm Dylan Matthews. We're doing things a little bit differently on the show this week and over the course of the next few Fridays, because as it turns out, we have learned a lot about policy and public health over the course of the last almost 2 years. So we're getting into the weeds of some of those lessons in a series we're calling America's Public Health Experiment. We hope you enjoy it. In 2020, the world changed forever.
We have a new name for the coronavirus. The World Health Organization has officially called it COVID-19.
Since Friday, the number of known infections across Asia has more than quadrupled.
COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
And nobody was prepared.
A SARS-like virus, which has infected hundreds in China, has now reached the United States.
In the past 2 weeks, the number of cases of COVID-19 outside China has increased 13-fold, and the number of affected countries has tripled.
Here in the United States, the response to COVID-19 was historic both in its successes and in its failures. Our inconsistent patchwork of social distancing rules made it really hard to get any sort of control over the spread of the virus.
Ohio shutting down public schools for 3 weeks. Maryland schools closed for two. California now banning all gatherings of 250 people or more. And New York City's mayor declaring a state of emergency.
Public health information was confusing and chaotic, and the system was nowhere near prepared for a public health crisis at this level. Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor to President Biden, testified in February 2020 that the American healthcare system just wasn't built for the level of widespread COVID-19 testing that was needed.
The system is not really geared to what we need right now, what you are asking for. That is a failing.
And it wasn't just testing. Our healthcare system is broken in a lot of ways. Hospitals and healthcare workers quickly became overwhelmed with patients. More than 775,000 people in the U.S. and over 5 million people globally died. But we also did a lot of good things. Trillions of dollars in economic relief passed through a divided Congress, was signed into law, and went directly into people's pockets. And in a remarkable scientific achievement, a vaccine was developed at an unprecedented speed.
This is a historic moment. The first trucks carrying the vaccine pulling out of the Pfizer plant, escorted by U.S. Marshals.
In recent weeks, hopes were raised when children ages 5 and up became eligible to receive the Pfizer vaccine. But the new Omicron variant is a reminder that new challenges and outbreaks could always be just around the corner. Which got us wondering, what about the next pandemic? Will we react better, smarter, faster next time? Because yes, there is going to be a next time. So, as I mentioned at the top, this month we're taking a deep dive to examine several pandemic-era policies in a series called America's Public Health Experiment. We'll explore what worked, what didn't, and what might work better next time. First up, the continued failure of testing. And for that, we turn to Weeds co-host Germán López.
Thanks, Dylan. I really think about the failure of testing in the U.S. as America's original sin with COVID. So early on in the pandemic, there were a lot of stories written about America's quote-unquote lost week or lost month. And despite the World Health Organization recommending a COVID test, the CDC tried to develop its own. But those CDC tests, they turned out to be botched. And because federal officials took so long to allow other tests, the U.S. failed to track the true scope of COVID in America. We were flying blind, and we couldn't respond as needed. Things are better now, with more tests readily available. But there are still big problems. In Europe, people can go to a local store and pick up free rapid tests. In the U.S., you just can't do that. Stores often don't carry rapid tests, and if they do, they're too expensive. $15, $20, or more for one or a set. To break down all of these problems and their causes, I spoke to Dr. Neeraj Sood. He's the director of the COVID Initiative at the University of Southern California Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. He's done a lot of work on COVID-19 testing, leading one of the quickest studies testing the U.S. population. Dr. Sood, welcome to The Weeds.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start this with going back to the early days of the pandemic. How did the U.S. originally botch testing? Because it seems to me like this has been a problem, not just now, but for a long time.
So I think one of the big mistakes we made early in the pandemic was that we started testing very late because we decided that we wanted to come up with our own test for COVID and not use the test that was being recommended by the WHO. So the CDC was in charge of coming up with their own test, and that process took much longer than anticipated. And in some sense, that process was botched because of some errors in the lab, which led to inaccurate tests being shipped to private labs across the U.S., realizing that we had made a mistake, trying to correct that mistake. And there we lost a few important weeks, where if we had started testing earlier, and if we had a robust contact tracing program with the testing program, we might have delayed the start of the pandemic in the U.S. And that's important because the delay could have been beneficial. For example, if the pandemic started 2 months later, maybe we would have had fewer cases before vaccines were approved in the U.S. And so we could have prevented some infections, like some of the people who got infected could have been vaccinated and would not have suffered the consequences of getting COVID.
Yeah, I remember reading articles early on about like the lost week, but what you're suggesting is actually even a longer time span. Like if we had a proper testing infrastructure in place earlier, we could have, I mean, it could have been months, it could have been much longer, as long as we're doing like the South Korea style strategy of testing and tracing, right? Where we're making sure to really tamp down on any case that pops up.
Yes. And the thing is that if there are a few cases, right, so the pandemic has just started and you have a handful of cases happening in different cities, maybe mainly related to travel, people coming into the U.S., that's when contact tracing can be really effective because you can test every person coming on every flight in the U.S. That's probably the source of the infection. Identify those cases. Do contact tracing, which is identify who's been in contact with them, isolate everyone early on, and then you stop the spread of the pandemic. At least you delay it. Ultimately, you know, this is a viral airborne disease. We cannot completely prevent it. Once the disease is already there in the population and there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of cases, doing robust contact tracing becomes exponentially difficult. Because for each of the 100,000 people or 200,000 people or million people, you're trying to figure out who they came in contact with and then isolate everyone. And doing that at that scale is just not possible, especially, you know, in a country as large and diverse as the U.S.
Well, was there a good reason for the CDC to develop its own test?
It's kind of like the story is that the perfect is the enemy of the good. And they wanted to make sure that they had their own formula and they had done their own due diligence on the test. But my thinking is, let's take a test that has been recommended by the WHO that is being used by other countries and get the testing program going. That doesn't mean that we cannot innovate and come up with better tests down the line.
So that was early on in the pandemic. I want to get a lay of the land of how things have changed. Like, how would you describe the current state of testing in the U.S., particularly compared to other developed countries?
So let's kind of take a step back and think about what is the purpose of testing, or, you know, why do we test people? And one purpose is diagnostic testing or clinical testing, which is I want to figure out whether you have COVID or you have the flu or you have a bacterial infection or something else. And then once I figure that out, I can give you appropriate treatment. And in the case of COVID, you know, now there are some treatments available, But for the most part of the pandemic, we really didn't have any treatment. So the value of testing from a diagnostic purpose is not very high. The second purpose of testing is to stop the spread of the disease, which is you want to, you know, identify people who are potentially infectious and can pass the disease to others in the population, and you want to limit that spread of disease. So if that's the situation, suppose you had COVID-like symptoms, you were probably already at home quarantining or isolating yourself. So in that sense, there's more value in testing individuals who have either really mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, because those are the individuals who are more likely to spread the disease rather than individuals who are really sick. And I think initially our focus of testing was just on individuals who were really sick, which means we didn't really do a good job of using testing to stop the spread of disease. That changed a few months into the pandemic when, you know, testing supply increased and we had more tests available where everyone could get tested. But initially, I think our approach of just limiting testing to those who are really sick did not really help us stop the spread of disease.
I wanted to ask you about this because, like, I've talked to, like, people in Europe, and in a lot of countries, it's really easy to get rapid tests, right, for cheap, if not free.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, people tell the story of, like, I'm going to get together with family or friends, so I get tested maybe twice even, which is a luxury we don't have, to make sure I'm not positive. And then I do my gathering and I feel safer knowing all of that.
Mm-hmm.
If you try that in the US, right, like that's just very difficult now. The tests are expensive. Do you think that's a fair representation of how this has gone here?
I think that's a fair representation. And again, this was, you know, the perfect being the enemy of the good. So there was this kind of consensus in the US that we should be using PCR tests because PCR tests are more accurate than rapid antigen tests.
What's the difference between these two?
The PCR test is testing your nasal swab or your saliva for genetic material from the virus. So if you do, that means you have an active infection. But it doesn't mean that you are infectious because, you know, you could have genetic material of the virus in your sample, but your viral load is low enough that you're not really infectious. So what rapid antigen tests do is they look for the antigen, which is kind of the protein in the virus, and it tries to identify people who have an active infection in that way. So it is possible that someone who is positive on the PCR test is negative on the rapid antigen test. And that was the benchmark that was used to say, look, rapid antigen tests are no good because I have this person who's positive on the PCR test and who's negative on the antigen test. So the antigen test is a false negative. But that's not a fair comparison because from a public health perspective, what we care about is not whether you have the genetic material from the virus in your sample. What we care about is, can you infect someone else? And rapid antigen tests do much better when their viral load is high or when you are more likely to infect others. The second thing is the time, right? So early on, PCR tests were in short supply. It took 4 or 5 days to get the results of a PCR test. Well, those 4 or 5 days, you've infected a lot of people while waiting for your results. So there is a trade-off between accuracy and time to results. And as you said, like a rapid antigen test, by its very name, you can get the result in 15 minutes. So I would rather take a test that has some false negatives, but that has a pretty good ability to identify individuals who are infectious and can give you results in 15 minutes versus a PCR test that is going to take several days early on in the pandemic to give results. So I'll give you an example. Like my daughter goes to a public school in Los Angeles, and they're required to do a PCR test every week during school hours. They're first pulled out of their classroom, so they're taking away time from education to testing. And then they all stand in the queue. they test for the PCR test, and the PCR test results are typically available after like 48 hours. So in some sense, what you're doing is you're confirming that there was someone who was PCR positive or potentially infectious in the school. You really haven't prevented that person from infecting others in the school. In fact, you made them all stand in a queue to get to get tested. So you've just confirmed that, oh, there might have been spread in the school rather than preventing that. And now if you just flip that and suppose you said that same school said, before my daughter entered the school campus, she had to take out a rapid antigen test result, which she could have done at home, and just show the negative result to whoever is at the gate. And as long as she has the negative result, she could enter the school. I think that would be a much better approach to testing. First, it's not taking time away from being in school and being in the classroom and getting an education. And second, it's actually preventing someone who's potentially infectious from entering the school.
I think one thing some people might be wondering is why this is necessary in a world with vaccines. I think I know the answer here, but how would you explain this concept to people that, like, even with vaccines, people still need these rapid tests available to them?
So first, not everyone is vaccinated, especially in schools. There might be a lot of children who are not vaccinated. I'm hoping a lot of the teachers and school staff are vaccinated, which does tremendously, you know, reduce the risk of having severe illness. So it ultimately comes to a calculation of how much risk tolerance do you have? Vaccines are very good, but they're not perfect, right? So even if you are vaccinated, you could get infection, a breakthrough infection. And some people with breakthrough infections do end up in the hospital or do end up with severe disease. So if you say that my risk tolerance is really low and I want to make sure no one or very few people end up in the hospital with severe disease, then you might want to do rapid antigen testing or some testing in a school environment. But you're right that there's a cost-benefit analysis to that. Like, how much money or time or resources do you want to spend in testing? The benefits of testing do reduce when a large fraction of the population is vaccinated or when the underlying prevalence of the disease is low in the community, right? So if you're doing 10,000 tests and identifying only 5 positive cases, maybe testing is not worth it. But if you're doing 10,000 tests and identifying 1,000 cases, testing is definitely worth it because the prevalence is so high that if you let all those people in, you would definitely have, you know, multiple outbreaks in schools and then schools would be shut. So it's really a calculation of what fraction of the population has protection from vaccination or from prior infection, and what is the underlying rate of disease in the community.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about some of the regulatory hurdles and other roadblocks that have slowed our ability to scale up rapid testing in the U.S.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P.
So why has the U.S. been so slow to adopt rapid testing? Are there regulatory hurdles? Is it about, like you've said, perfect being the enemy of good? Like, what's going on here?
I think the reason has been regulatory hurdles. as well as maybe the capacity of the FDA to evaluate these tests. So compare our rapid antigen test to, say, a pregnancy test. Both have, in some sense, from a consumer perspective, a very similar technology, right? That it's like a little cassette that you get, you put a sample in it, a line appears, the line says either you're positive, like which means you might be pregnant, or in the case of a rapid antigen test, which might mean you have COVID. But in the case of the pregnancy test, that's it. You know you're pregnant, you can discard the test, and then you're done. In the case of the rapid antigen test, you're supposed to report that positive result to the local public health department. And now the local public health department has to know that it is your result and not somebody else's result. That test comes with an app. The app has to have these features where that results can be reported. And a test which doesn't have a good process of reporting the results and verifying the results will not be approved by the FDA. What this means is there are only a few rapid tests now that are available where, you know, it's the large companies who have the wherewithal to figure out this process, figure out the regulations, and then those tests are expensive. So I think right now, like, a pack of two tests costs $25. That's not a trivial amount of money to be testing frequently, right, for a lot of people. Even though probably the production cost of just that cassette is probably $1 or $2. So something that costs maybe $2 to produce is being sold at, you know, $15 a piece or something similar to that. And that makes a big difference. The other thing is some people might just feel uncomfortable reporting their positive results to a local public health department. You know, they just might have fear of the government or whatever. You know, they don't want people calling them and saying, like, who did you hang out with? They might prefer to, like, do it themselves. So that might create a barrier to testing, where if, you know, I could test and I find out I'm positive and I just stay at home and, you know, I tell a few of my friends who I hung out with that, hey, I'm positive, maybe you guys should test on your own. I think maybe more people might be willing to do such testing compared to the process we have right now.
To focus on the FDA a bit, I mean, you gave this example of the benchmark of using like a PCR test to say whether an antigen test is actually like accurate. I don't know. I guess like what I'm trying to understand here is if the FDA, how they're evaluating these rapid tests, how they're approving them and letting them go to market, is that process, like in your view, wrong? Should they have taken a different approach to saying whether this test is accurate enough to be consumed by the public? Like what exactly should change there?
I just read a story which said there are over 300 applications sitting with the FDA for review, and FDA just doesn't have the bandwidth to review all those applications in time. And I also know anecdotally by talking to CEOs of startups who were coming up with rapid antigen tests that the review process was very onerous and took a lot of time. So I think that's probably one of the big hurdles, that it's taking the FDA a lot of time to review these tests. The data I've looked at, some of the tests that have been approved, or not approved, but that have got what is called an emergency use authorization, that data is actually not very onerous because it's based on really small sample sizes. So to evaluate the accuracy of the test, the sample of like positive individuals for which you need, say, both a PCR test and a rapid antigen test, I think that sample size is around 30, which is not a huge sample to really figure out how accurate a test is. So I would like have preferred much larger sample sizes, but then for rapid antigen tests, not just comparing it to PCR, but looking at how accurate they are when the viral load is high, or when, you know, for the PCR, the term is when the CT cycles or the CT threshold is lower, which is like the number of times you had to amplify the sample to detect the genetic material of the virus. So the fewer times you have to magnify, the larger is the viral load. So I would kind of focus the validation on people who had high viral load and then compare the accuracy of the rapid antigen test relative to the PCR test.
Is this changing under the current administration? Does the process seem to be improving at all in terms of like getting more tests done, or is this something that's still a major hurdle?
I still think it's a major hurdle. I haven't seen any news or announcements about change in FDA policy on saying like we're going to devote more resources to expedite approval or authorization of these tests. I haven't seen anything or any change in stance where they are changing their standards on how they evaluate these tests.
One thing I've heard a lot from when I talk to people like who aren't following COVID news that closely, but they know enough about like the tests to know that like sometimes they return false positives or negatives. I mean, they're just worried about that in general. I guess like, how do you respond to those kinds of concerns? Like when you're doing this mass testing strategy to hopefully make sure people, you prevent the spread of the disease and you still get some false positives or negatives, how do you explain why that might be okay? Like why that's something that you, I mean, it's obviously not something that somebody prefers, but it's a manageable problem.
Again, it depends on the context, right? So if the disease prevalence is really low, then the false positives are a bigger problem because it might turn out that most of the people who are testing positive are false positives because the true positives in the population are at such a low level. But when the disease prevalence rises, then false positives become less of a concern because most of the people you might be identifying are the true positives. There are more true positives in the population compared to people who might have false positives. So I think that's the way to think about the false positives, that false positives really don't matter when disease prevalence is high. False positives only matter when the disease prevalence is really low. And you can address the false positives through serial testing. You might have one test that's a false positive, but then if you retest, the likelihood that both tests are false positives is very low. And on the problem of false negatives, you know, yes, a test might have false negatives, but as long as it's identifying individuals who are positive and infectious, it is still benefiting society because it's still reducing disease spread, right? So yes, we're not identifying everyone who's positive, but as long as we identify a high fraction of individuals who are positive, it's not that big of a deal because we're still reducing disease spread in a significant way as long as we identify a lot of individuals who are positive and infectious.
One thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is just the broader implications of the U.S. failing to adopt a rigorous testing regime. I mean, in terms of like pandemic preparedness, not just for COVID, but in future pandemics, do you think this has implications there? Like, is there anything that concerns you in that regard?
So I hope with future pandemics, we don't make the same mistakes again. So I think we need to, in some sense, be more willing to introduce good tests in the market earlier or good treatments in the market earlier, and then evaluate them post-market launch rather than delaying their entry by a few months to just make sure that they're perfect. Because, you know, in those few months, a lot of people can get infected and, you know, something that could be controlled can become something that's a pandemic and is uncontrolled.
It also seems to me like the longer you don't get these things to market, the longer people are going to take to actually start doing contact tracing and learning how to do contact tracing, right? A lot of these things seem mm-hmm. like, in theory, people know how to contact trace, but doing it in the real world mm-hmm. is a challenge, right? Like
yeah.
It's something you have to learn how to do, even if you have a plan for
yeah.
it, right? So if you take longer to get tests out there, that might be a problem, right?
And, you know, it was the same thing with the vaccines that I don't understand. So, you know, there was a clinical trial done, and the clinical trial is important to judge the efficacy and safety of the vaccine. But why couldn't the FDA meet the very next hour after that clinical trial completed data collection to look at the data and make a decision on whether this vaccine should be approved or not? Again, like introducing a vaccine 1 month early would have made a huge difference. Like maybe we would have avoided the big spike we got after Thanksgiving if we had started vaccinating people earlier. And the clinical trial was completed earlier, but then it takes the government, you know, a few weeks to evaluate that data and have a committee meeting and then, you know, come up with a decision to approve the vaccine. And that would be fine for a lot of products. But when you're kind of in this emergency, when there's like a fire in the house, you cannot evaluate like how good the fire engine is. You know, if there's a fire engine there, let them start the work and you can figure out what else we can do then, or, you know, whether we need a better fire engine and so on. But I think we are in this mode where we take a lot of time to evaluate things. And that really has an implication for public health that we're not fully capturing.
For anyone who listens to this podcast, they probably know that I'm personally pretty pessimistic about how some things are going, especially with the pandemic. But I wanted to like just ask you this in another way, I guess, which is, given the problems you're listing and given, like you mentioned, that you don't see very many improvements in terms of how testing is getting out there, do you worry that we are going to make the same mistakes in the next pandemic, that we are like really haven't done much to improve our pandemic preparedness in general?
So I guess I am a little bit more optimistic. I agree that we made mistakes, but I think there's definitely some learning that has happened as a result of this pandemic. First is there is this realization that pandemics, you know, 1 in 100 year events do actually happen, right? Like before this, a lot of people would have just brushed it aside that, yeah, you know, it's all theoretical. This stuff doesn't really happen. So I think the realization is there. And, you know, both industry and government have been working hard for the past 20 months in dealing with this pandemic. And I think there have been some changes as a result of that. So I think they would be better prepared for the pandemic. But that said, I don't, you know, if you say our response is going to be top notch, I don't think so. I think there's still a lot of problems that haven't been solved. And there is still a lot of kind of thinking that hasn't changed.
Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you about is just the broader surveillance capabilities of the U.S. So I think it's particularly relevant this week as we're learning about Omicron and how that was discovered, how apparently some European countries missed it for weeks. Like, obviously, testing plays a role in this kind of surveillance and genomic surveillance and all that stuff. But I'm curious, what do you make of that? Like, how does testing play a role in that? Where do you see the faults there?
So I can give you, you know, an example from my own experience. Early on in the pandemic, say in February or early March, you know, the reports from WHO and others were that this is a disease that has a mortality rate of around 3%. And that was very alarming. And that was, you know, one of the reasons why we were planning on kind of shutting down the economy or doing the shelter in place orders. And, you know, a lot of epidemiologists know that the cases we were identifying then were just based on testing individuals who were symptomatic or who had, in some sense, pretty severe symptoms. So we might be missing a lot of infections that were just people with mild symptoms or people with no symptoms at all. And so the way to understand what was going on in the population was to do something called a seroprevalence study, which is basically taking a random sample of the population and testing them for antibodies against the disease, because those antibodies persist in your blood even after you're over an active infection. So they truly tell you how many people in the population have ever been infected with COVID. And so you would think that, you know, the CDC or others would be the first out of the gate to launch a big, you know, surveillance study to understand what was going on in the population, how many people actually had COVID. And again, they were planning a perfect study. They took months to do it. And I was able to do it with 50 volunteer students in Los Angeles, where we got a random sample of people from LA County to come. We set up 8 testing sites. We got some antibody tests from China. And, you know, we were able to do the seroprevalence study. You know, I'm not tooting my own horn, but I just feel that I would have expected a much faster, better response from the CDC on understanding the signs of COVID or doing the surveillance testing to really understand what's going on at the population level. And I see similar things right now that South Africa is identifying a new variant. We'll find out in a few months whether that variant was truly first there in South Africa or was actually there present in multiple other countries who didn't put in the effort to do the genetic sequencing to find out the variants. So I don't think despite how rich we are investing enough in surveillance or in the science to really understand what's going on at the population level. Similarly, we don't know what is the rate of breakthrough infections in the US. We don't know how many people with prior infections are getting hospitalized or not. Like one of the statistics you hear is most of the people in the hospital are unvaccinated, but the unvaccinated is a very diverse group. There are two types of unvaccinated, those with prior infection and those without a prior infection. So those with prior infection could actually have protection, but we have no data, systematic data, which speaks to that. So I just feel like the countries like UK and Israel have done a much better job at disease surveillance to understand what's happening. And we are kind of either relying on that evidence, but we are not producing that same high quality evidence in the US.
To your point, to this day, it remains the case that the vast majority of testing is still symptomatic people, right? But we know that COVID can spread through asymptomatic people. And, you know, it would be nice to know how many vaccinated people might have gotten an infection and not realized it because a vaccine stamped it down and were infectious for some period, but we're still not doing that. We're still kind of flying blind in this regard, right?
Another example is COVID in children. So we don't know even today how many children in the US have had COVID because we've never done a large-scale seroprevalence study in the US to understand how many children have had COVID. And knowing that number is critically important because it tells us how deadly COVID is for children, right? So right now, we just know only children who are symptomatic or now in the school, when schools have opened and some of the schools are doing testing, we only know a very small sliver of children who are COVID positive because they somehow got tested. There could be thousands or millions of children who've had COVID and we don't even know about it. And that changes our estimates of how fast this disease spreads in children, how deadly it is for children. And in the absence of that information, we're still making major policy decisions like we decided to shut down our schools. Why are we making those major policy decisions without having the knowledge that we could easily get by investing a few million dollars into it? And it's just perplexing to me why we still don't know some of this basic information.
And just to make this clear, the issue here is that shutting down schools obviously has detrimental effects on kids. So if it turns out that COVID is not as big of a threat as we fear in kids, then we don't want to do that. We don't want to shut down schools because we've seen learning loss. We've seen the problems there, right?
So right now, if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics website, they estimate the number of children who have had a confirmed case of COVID. And then they look at the deaths in children. And their estimate of the mortality is that 1 in 10,000 children who have a confirmed case of COVID have died from COVID. So that's a very small mortality risk. But that risk could actually be even much smaller than that because there could be all these children who had asymptomatic disease, were never tested, and therefore they are not in that denominator of the number of confirmed cases. So the number of total cases or number of children infected could be four times larger than the number of children who got COVID, which means the mortality risk is not 1 in 10,000, it could be 1 in 40,000. And that should change your calculus about, okay, now if you shut down the schools, who is benefiting from that? And what is the benefit to the children? What is versus what is the benefit to others in society from shutting down schools. So shutting down schools, you know, seems, again, a policy decision made without the evidence. You would need to really make a policy decision based on the benefits and cost of the decision to children.
Dr. Sood, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been an interesting conversation.
That's all for us today. Thanks again to Dr. Sood for coming on the show. Our producer is Sophie Lalonde. Libby Nelson is our editorial advisor. Amber Hall is the deputy editorial director for Talk Podcast. And I'm Herman Lopez. Sadly, this is my last episode of The Weeds. It's a bittersweet moment for me, but I'm really excited that I'm going to the New York Times to write the morning newsletter. Speaking of newsletters, The Weeds newsletter will keep showing up in your inbox on Fridays. Darlin will be filling in for me, and it's going to be great. To sign up, go to vox.com/weedsletter. Also, keep an eye out in the morning at the New York Times.